G'day team, welcome to another instalment of The U Project. It's Harps, it's Tiff, it's us, it's Mariam, who you're about to meet in a moment. It's Thursday, it's heading towards dinner time, it's 5:05 as Tiff presses the record button. And I'm excited about our guest today. But before we say hello to her, we'll say hello to the glue that keeps, or part, one half of the glue that keeps the show together. Hi, Tiff.
I feel like I'm 15% of the stickiness, really. I feel like Melissa holds 85% of that together.
Nah, I think when it comes to the show, it's an even split. The rest of my life, she kind of sticky tapes together because, as I was saying to Mariam, I am a ship without a rudder and I need you two guiding forces, kind of beams of light in the darkness of me to illuminate the path before me, the path of righteousness, brothers and sisters. So anyway, hi, Mariam Issa, how are you?
I'm very well, Craig. Very well. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think you quite know what you've got yourself in for coming on this show because it's a little bit of mayhem. And in my 3 minutes talking to you before we pressed the go button, I feel like I could get in trouble because you're very well spoken and very decent and very and you told me that before that your name Mariam in the Christian tradition is Mary and Issa is Jesus. So we could call you Mary Jesus.
Yes, you could. And I think maybe that's where you go to your righteousness action. But believe me, that I'm not all that.
Well, if loving the Lord's wrong, I don't want to be right. Now, are you a woman of faith, Mariam?
Yes, I am a woman of faith, but very spiritual faith. I am of the Islamic traditions. Mm-hmm. And yes, I've thrown the dogma out and I just hold the essence of, the Quran, and I practice it, yes.
Well, good for you. I think if we can get the religious bit out of religion, that it might be a lot better place for people to go. I'm with you. When you say you kind of got rid of the dogma, what does that mean for you?
It means the do's and don'ts that we don't usually get in the practical life, like in religious style. It's a very patriarchal religion. So it's women have to do this, or it has to be this way. And yeah, I think that type of religion is now out. And what we really have in is very the spiritual, the essence of it. And I think I used to practice that even as a child, And there's that essence that lives, and that love and essence of any religion really lives in every human being. It might not come as a religion, but it comes as, a pathway that is installed within each and every one of us. Mm. And that's how we find our balance when we just, we go out into the world and sometimes the ego pulls us all directions. But when we learn to find our way home and to find our way into the heart, then that's the true, the true balance. And as you mentioned before, it's where, the sheep needs to be guided, needs someone to, and to find anchor as well. You can't be all on the sea all the time. You have to come back home and you have to find an anchor.
Well, I'm definitely a sheep and I definitely need some guidance. So I think this is a timely encounter for me. Did you, when you were growing up, and we're going to go all over the place, I try not to, as you might anticipate right now, Mariam, I try not to plan these talks. I try to just be in the moment. But did you feel when you were growing up, apart from the indoctrination or the programming or the conditioning of your environment and your family and the religion, did you feel an innate spiritual awareness or sense of something that was kind of just in you rather than forced upon you?
Yes, and I think both my parents, my background is a nomadic background. So both my parents lived a nomadic life.
Wow.
And so my mother was a very intuitive woman. And I think because of her, her interaction with nature and really being connected to nature, she had this innate program. She had this intuition. And in our culture, the Somali culture, we say, you know, lihlihat, which means the six senses. You know, in the West, we only talk about the five senses, but in our traditions, we talk about the six senses. And the sixth sense being the, you know, the innate, the guidance. So the intuition. And so that was really programmed early on, you know, even without religion, by my mother's stories. I think that was a way in which she seeded her love and she seeded what was righteous within us.
I love that. Righteous. Yeah. I feel like because a lot of us now, by virtue, Mariam, of the situation or the environment that a lot of us live in, which is very urban, very concrete, very bitumen, very kind of unnatural per se, that we've become disconnected from that innate wisdom, from that knowing, from that deep sense of who I am in the ecosystem of the world. Mm-hmm. Like we are not, we don't go into nature, we are nature. We're part of, I think Mark Kluwer, one of our guests, illuminated us with that tiff. Yeah. He said, I don't have to go into nature because I am nature, but we've kind of removed ourselves from the natural environment, and which is understandable. That's in some ways progress and in some ways regress. But I feel like that innate knowing and that paying attention to that, I don't know, I call it my internal sat nav, my inner guidance system. I feel like we've become disconnected from that the more that we move away from the natural world.
Yeah, I think we do. We do. And I think when I came to the West and, you know, it was really a very alien world to me. And I might say alien, not only in the sense of disconnection from nature, but disconnect from community. You know, I had, you know, I came through the as a refugee, and I had seen a whole, you know, a whole country, a whole, existence disintegrate right in front of my eyes because a civil war happened. And the neighbors who were friends, who were family, turned against us. And it was all of a sudden a chaotic lifestyle. And so coming to the West and being given refuge here and coming into a very, you know, we were very lucky refugees, by the way, because we came through the family reunion visa. And so my brother-in-law lived in Cheltenham, and that's how we now still live in the same house that I came into, which is in East Brighton. So at the time, it was in 1998, November of 1998, Brightoners had not interacted with many Africans. And so we stood out as a family. And I remember the first interaction with our next door neighbor was him coming to our doorway and saying, you know, your children's ball is in my court. And my dogs dig. I don't like that. And by the way, I'm John, your next door neighbor.
Oh, wow.
And that was his introduction. And at the time, we were watching Neighbours, Craig. So that was very alien to me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it wasn't the way we interacted as a community, as a communal culture. And at that time, I was a very communal person because I had not found my individuality yet. And I feel that wherever we come to, we don't come to any place randomly. We are somewhere because we've been invited there and there is something, a lesson, something to be given to us. And what I realized is that my lesson in the West and especially in Brighton was to find my individuality. But also to remind others about communal, the communal culture of dependency. We have to depend on each other as well.
It's interesting. It's almost like a contradiction because on the one way, on the one hand, we want to figure out who we are. You know, we want to discover ourselves away from our tribe or our group or our family, but we don't want to be disconnected at the same time.
No,
but sometimes you can lose yourself in a group. you know.
Totally, totally. So that's what I found out. I found out that, dependency on its own does not work, and independence on its own does not work. So yes, when we combine the two, it's miraculous, because even the language says it, it's interdependence.
Yeah.
So in the interdependence, we self-actualize.
Yes.
And we bring the Ubuntu spirit. And in our African culture, the Ubuntu spirit is I am because you are. If there is no you, there is no me. So that's the level of connectedness that we can practice when we reach this space of self-actualization.
How do I spell that?
Ubuntu is U-B-U-N-T-U, Ubuntu. And it's a Zulu word from South Africa.
U-B-U-N. Spell it again.
U-B-U-N-T-U, Ubuntu.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the name of our show. That's what we're calling this episode, because people are going to go, what is that? I'm going to say, well, tune in, bro.
Yeah.
You'll find out.
Yes.
Where do you, like, I've been speaking to you for 10 minutes. You're wise. Are you wise because that's innate? Are you wise because of where you've been, your journey? Or have you done a lot of deep self-reflection? Or is it wisdom that's been handed down from your mum and dad? And where does this come from?
I think, Craig, that we are all wise. And the thing about human beings is we love expression. We love to explore and then express ourselves. But one part that we jump over is integration. We usually do not integrate our experiences.
Right.
And that's the place where, once you have explored and you've expressed, if you integrate your experiences, then you transform. That's the place of transformation. That's the place where change happens. Mm. That's the place when you now have a formula, you're not afraid to fail.
Mm.
Because you can integrate and you can say, well, I've seen this story. I can see how it looks like. I don't like it. I'm going to create differently.
Mm.
And so as a storyteller, that's what I figured out along the way, that I was the molder and the shaper and the designer of my story. And that comes with a lot of, as you said, it comes with a lot on sitting on the mat and reflections and, connecting with self, having a lot of this pain. It's just like childbirth. You have to, feel this pain, and you have to see where it's coming from, and then you have to integrate it and to bring some light and shade some light on it and let it go.
I love it. I feel like sometimes, Mariam, that some of the doors that we need to open are not doors we want to open,
yes.
Metaphorically.
Yes. Like yes.
It's like I need to, because there's some stuff here I need to acknowledge or deal with or become aware of or pay attention to or take action on, but opening this door is going to hurt a bit. For me, that introspection, that self-reflection that ties in with kind of self-awareness and maybe self-actualization, that some of that deep stuff where you have to what we call in Australia sometimes going to the room of mirrors, which is kind of having a look at yourself.
Absolutely.
Sometimes that can be both painful and cathartic, right?
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think, it's about disintegrating the system, because you look at that and it shatters. And then when it shatters, you have to put the pieces together again. And that's what integration is about. So a whole system disintegrated in front of me, it shattered, and I started a new, I came to a new community. I started a new way of life, and it was making sense of that life and putting those pieces together. And it was like, what is mine and what is not?
Wow.
And from there, what I realized is that I came with a culture, and culture, I refer to it as a currency, and my currency was totally deflated. It didn't have any value in this system or place that I'd arrived. But the amazing thing was, even the currency that I was given, I wasn't able to trade with it either. because I didn't know anything about it. So it was between, you know, a hard place and a rock. That is, you know, my way of putting it. But yeah, it was really tumultuous and really hard. But I think being a mother and having come with children and having a curious nature, all that was my support system. That's what supported me to be part of, you know, to brave this journey, because not everyone can look at it and can make sense of it.
It's interesting when you, when you're in a certain operating system, like I've lived in the same house for 26 years. Is that right? 95. Yeah. And I kind of have, you know, certain people in my life and I do certain things and I'm quite, I like doing new things and I try to have new experiences, but you have your own kind of paradigm that you live in socially, emotionally, culturally, religiously, spiritually, behaviorally. That's your kind of normal operating system. And then you get transplanted, as you did, from your world to, it may as well be Mars or Jupiter.
Yes.
Like you get, not only are you in a different place, but it's like almost a different time. It's a different culture. It's everything. It's like everything. There are so many, you know, you're a human amongst other humans, but it's, there are so many things for you to adapt to and learn and understand and process. What were, I mean, I'm sure there were many things, but just one or two things that spring to mind that when you arrived here that was really either difficult or weird for you to navigate?
I think one of the hardest, the simplest one was going into Woolworths.
Yeah.
At the time it was called Safeways, and shopping for my five children and having these many aisles of just bread to choose, you know, and milk. There was milk in every, you know, a whole aisle of milk and bread. And I came from a system which it was just a kiosk. You bought bread, and if you, you know, you woke up around 9 a.m., it was gone. There was no more bread. And here you had all these choices. So it was like taking a child into this, you know, big candy store and, you know, telling them to choose from it. So that was exhausting, literally, very exhausting to shop.
Isn't it funny how when you've got one or two choices, you go, I'll have that. But when you've got 50 choices, it can bring with it anxiety. Now you've got more.
You've got it. Yes, anxiety. And it was also because of my religious background. I had to look at the labels and see what had pork and what didn't have, you know. It was so, it was crazy. To this day, I don't like shopping. And I think it comes from that, yeah, that experience.
Well, no retail therapy for you, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Mariam, you arrived here when you were 30, is that correct?
Yes, I arrived when I was 30 years old.
Now, I know this is a stupid question I'm about to ask you, but I want to shut up for a while and let you just tell your story. Between when you were born and when you got here, now I know that's a three-hour conversation, but can you maybe share as much of that as you'd like and go where you want to go about where you grew up, what that was like, your experiences, good and bad, whatever you want to share, whatever you're comfortable to, you know, kind of a 5 or 10 minute snapshot of life before Australia for us?
Sure. I did write a whole book around, you know, about
what's the book? Tell us the book title.
The book title is called A Resilient Life. Wow. Previously would have been Black in Brighton, but I just didn't want the connotations that would come with that. So
I don't hate that title, but anyway,
yeah, a lot of people love it.
Yeah,
but I called it A Resilient Life. I think it was a resilient life. And you know, I was born in Somalia, a small town called Kismayu, 500 kilometers away from Mogadishu, the, you know, the capital city. And I was born to two parents who were both of the nomadic culture, but at that time they'd come and settled in the city, some, you know, Kismayu, not much of a city, but, you know, so much better than being in the nomadic lifestyle. And then my father got into political trouble and was exiled from Somalia in 1969, after a year after I was born. And so we then migrated to a small town in Kenya called Malindi. And Malindi is actually very much known for its beautiful tourist destination. It is a tourist destination. It's got beautiful beaches, and one of the, you know, it had silver sands and so beautiful town. But it also was at that time a very small, kind of a like village type city. So when we arrived, you know, people think that Africa is just this one country, but we've got different cultures. So we migrated into that country, that small town, and the people who lived there were the indigenous people who looked after their land, and they were very much primitive at the time. So most of them didn't even wear much clothing. And so my mom was, you know, horrified coming into that culture. But a few months after we lived there, the chief of the small town called her and said, you know, he called her and gifted her a land and said, cultivate this land for your children. Wow. But yeah, and but my mother, not knowing much about growing things, she was always a nomad and she knew about animals, but not the land, refused. And not only because of that, but because she didn't speak the language. And she was also felt alienated, you know, like an alien in this culture, like this is different. So we had almost 2 years, I think, I remember, our doors were bolted, like she would not let anyone in. But having refused that and all that, we were never excluded from the harvest of that little town. Mm. We always had a box of fruits and vegetables on our doors. And when my mother realized that, she started a small tuck shop in our home. And that is where she started cooking Somali food and started sharing our culture. Mm. And I feel sometimes that that is the seed that was planted while I was growing up that really germinated in Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So... And then I grew up in Malindi. I went to school. I was a very, you know, curious child and I loved languages. So I was speaking the Swahili language fluently. And then I learned how to read through my brother's books. I saw my brother bring books.
Yeah. We're
not allowed as girls to go to school. And I just started learning from his books, making sense of some of the words and asking him. And then my youngest brother at the time was sent to school and my mother said, you're not going to school because you're a girl. And, you know, her duty as a Somali woman was to prepare me for my future husband, you know, wow. The cooking and chores that, yeah. But I feel like my mind wasn't ready to do these chores. I wanted to do other things. And so I feel that I was a very strategic young child back then because I implanted a seed of fear in my mother's head, knowing that her youngest son, and she loved her son, he was the youngest, but he was also a boy, and I said he would be bullied in school. So I would protect him if she sent me to school with him. So I went to school as a bodyguard for my younger brother.
Oh, you are super. How old were you when you came up with that little strategy?
I was only 6 years old when I came up with that. And yeah, so, and I did really well in school. I was a debater. I loved communication. I loved talking, you know, my mind. I wanted to make changes. So I feel that even young back then, I hated the tourists that came to our, you know, our little town, because I would see them, like when I was a young teenager, I would see them, you know, holding the hands of my, you know, the young African girls. And I felt that that was unjust. And I remember I used to write about it. And then we had this incredible teacher who asked us to write morning news. And we had a board that we would put our morning news. And that's how we expressed our ideas.
Wow.
And yeah. So my childhood was a really beautiful one because it was one of interaction. We, you know, our school was actually, we built our school. There was no school. It was just a big land with a lot of mango trees. And we went to school under a mango tree and then started building the classrooms ourselves. because our teacher told us to bring a stone every day. And we threw a stone in this beautiful pillar that we made, and then it became the resource of the school, which we built afterwards.
Wow.
Yeah, so I feel that, you know, back then, I remember the creativity and innovations and how, you know, we made something out of nothing.
Isn't it amazing? Like, you must now, living where you live and being in 2021 Australia with all the resources and technology and computers and Zoom and, you know, it almost seems respectfully like you're talking about something from centuries ago, but it was literally your life.
Yes.
Where you know, it still happens today, of course, where girls are not allowed to go to school in some places. And did you, when you were that young girl and then a teenager, absorbing the world and learning and exploring your curiosity and writing and debating? I'm glad I didn't debate you. I would have got massacred. Did you have an idea of what you would do, who you would be, what your mission might become?
Not really. I don't think that we had that kind of a dream planted in us. I think it was like, you are a woman, you're going to be married, you will have a child, you will have children, you'll take care of your children. So that was pretty much the dream. So, and I feel like our teachers did as much as they could. They did give us inspirations. They talked to us about, you know, different role models, but those role models weren't around us. We right. couldn't see them. So, and I do feel that it's so true. If you cannot see it, you cannot be it.
Yeah.
In sometimes. And, you know, despite the fact that I've read a lot of books and but the books that I was reading was about mystery and adventure and all that. So I did have adventures and I did, you know, go through life in that way. But I wasn't a conscious creator until I came to the West. Yeah.
And did I read that before you got to Australia, you'd lived in 6 or 5 countries, or how did... Is that true?
I don't usually say this because there's a lot. I didn't want to, you know, the connotation to be that Africa is about wars and all that. But we did go through the Uganda, civil war as well, because at the time we were living in Uganda. We left Kenya. We lived in Uganda for a time. And then the Idi Amin civil war happened and we had to leave. And then I lived back to Somalia and Qatar in the Arab world. And then I also lived in the United Arab Emirates.
And tell us about how you came to be come to go on a refugee journey to Australia. How did that come about? What precipitated that?
So we, after the civil war in 1991, I was pregnant with my third child then, and I was only 23 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I went through the journey of being a refugee from Somalia to Kenya. And so we left by a boat with 2 very young children. My husband at the time wasn't there, and he was in the Arab world. So I left Somalia with these 2 young children, 2 and 3 years old, and pregnant 6 months. And then on the shores, we were actually suspended in a boat for 3 days and 3 nights. And we reached the shores.
What do you mean suspended? You mean like
suspended?
So the military wouldn't let you come ashore, or the government or something?
Yeah. So we went, the journey was 3 days, but 3 nights, the boat was not secure enough to make the journey. So every night the engine would be turned off and we had to be in water. So we would only do our travel during the day. And then when we reached the shores of Kenya, the Kenyans would not let us in, even though I held a Kenyan passport.
Right.
And I was told that I should leave my children behind if, you know, yes, you're Kenyan, but leave your kids behind. And so there was this political, you know, thing going between Kenya and Uganda and Somalia. So it was like they wanted to turn the boat back to where it came from. But the lucky enough, the Red Cross were there, and the Red Cross actually rescued us.
Can you, I mean, I don't know how deep you want to go, but can you tell us what that was like? There must have been so much fear and anxiety and unknown and, you know, trying to protect your kids and create a future for them. And what was that experience like?
So the experience, actually, some, you know, people, when we're looking it from outside in, it looks really horrendous. But when you're in it, it's different, because then you're in a survival mode. It is what it is. And it was a small boat, and I don't even think it could, you know, be, it could pass on as a boat in the Australian standards. And it had 140 people in it, mostly women and children and elders. And so we didn't have enough food, we didn't have water, and you could, you know, the during the day, you could feel the turmoil, you could feel the fear, the anxiety, the, you know, the cries of the children, the groans of the elders, pain, and we didn't have any medical in on you know, on the boat. And but during the night, it was totally a different experience. During the night, you could feel the, you know, the macroness, like the big, you see the stars. I've never seen the stars so close before, you know, so I could see the stars, and it was so quiet, and it sort of gave me a perspective. And there was this, you know, the shore, the water, like you could hear the water, you know, knocking on the boat. And that was sort of like a lullaby for me, that, you know, singing, saying, you know, there's a better tomorrow. Don't you worry. Things will be better. So I felt reassured during the nights. And I think something at that time really expanded for me. A deep trust came in. And yeah, I knew that we were going to make on shore. But during the day, none of that was, you know, was visible. During the day, you were thinking, what if someone died, and how are we going to deal with the body? Should we throw it off, you know, overboard, or would? And then my son, you know, there was a diarrhea in the, you know, in the boat. One of my youngest son caught the diarrhea, and we were all on the, you know, on our toes, just trying to survive. Yeah.
What was your overwhelming or prevalent emotion, feeling, mental state when you got to Australia? What did you feel when you got to Australia? Was it excitement, apprehension? I don't know. What was it?
I think I was so tired, Craig. I was so tired. I was, again, pregnant, 6 months pregnant when I came with my fifth child and last child. So I felt that I was really, I just wanted to have to rest. And so when I came and we were given this house that I live in now, my children and husband were like, no, this is not a place that we can live, because it looked so weird. And it's a house that hasn't been occupied for 6 years, and it had all the grass grown up, and it's an old house. And I was like, no, this is, you know, I don't want to move anymore. This is a permanent, this is permanent housing. I'm just going to stay here. And so I just started a life, and I wanted to create that semblance of, you know, just living and not being, because we were displaced for 8 years before we came. So by that time I was like, no, I just want to have a life now.
I ask this with some trepidation, because I'm not sure I want the answer, but how were you received by people when you first got here? Well, if you'd live next door to me, I would have come and give you all a hug, and I would have brought you a casserole, and I would have been, you know, I would have been the best neighbor ever. So I'm sorry you didn't get me, but
I didn't get you, Greg. I wish
you did get me, because you would have had a different experience. But anyway,
maybe I needed to do some more learning about humanity. And it wasn't easy. I think, you know, and one of the hardest things that I tell even now as a speaker, when I tell my audience, is the labels that are put on you, the assumptions that people make about you that are unspoken. Yeah. I could deal with the ones that are spoken because, you know, when someone tells you something, it can be out of curiosity. It can be like you can defend yourself.
Yes.
But when that energy is projected onto you that has this load of, you know, hate and, you know, you can't do anything with it.
Mm.
It's not spoken. And I think the Westerners do that a lot, you know, very well.
Mm.
Yeah, they're very polite, but they'll look at you and it's like, ooh, what hit me? And I think I'm a very sensitive and very intuitive person, so I could feel energy.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I think that was the worst. But other than that, I think, you know, our humanity is intact. And the amazing thing I learned in this journey is that, you know, the atrocities that man can commit is so horrendous and so horrifying. But one act, a simple act of a stranger, a simple act of kindness from a stranger can unravel years and years of hatred and make you, you know, have kind of like believe in humanity again. So I think kindness is incredible, and a lot of people, I've met a lot of people who are kind.
Do you remember, Mariam, the first significant time when you got here and you're in that messy house and the grass was everywhere and you were carrying your fifth child and you were exhausted and old mate from next door wasn't very nice? And when was the first time that somebody surprised you with kindness? Do you remember?
I remember the one from teachers, from school, a parent of one of my youngest daughters. I remember that, you know, parents can be cruel sometimes. You know, I remember standing in, you know, in a group, like they start, you drop your child off and then there's all these groups of like, and then you go to one group and you feel like you want to talk and belong and all that, you know, just extend yourself. And then everybody leaves. It's like, oh, I've got to do this. And they leave. And then I remember this one parent who took the time to invite me and to invite me, one, introduce me into the coffee culture and buy me a coffee. And say, well, you know, tell me what's your story. So that is a big, I could never forget. I never forget that woman ever.
It's so amazing that through all the stuff that you went through, the big, scary, terrifying, uncertain stuff, and that's such a little but beautiful act of kindness, is still all these years later very significant to you. Tell us what you do now. Tell us about your mission and your purpose and your storytelling, and tell us what you do and what you want to do moving forward.
Yeah, so I did a lot of things to begin with. I started as, I knew that my culture, you know, my currency was deflated, so I had to give it some strength. So I started, I looked in my mind, I said, what can I do? And I realized that we have a wealth of beautiful things in our culture, and one of them was food. So I started this project called Cook with Mariam. And it was a business. It wasn't just a project. I was doing it as a business. And I did it for 5 years. I went into Brighton Homes and I started, you know, cooking with them and teaching them about my culture. And that worked really beautifully. But what I was doing in that as well is sort of an, you know, I was an activist, and I knew that the best social, I could create best, you know, social cohesion is created best with connection, but also with food. You know, through food, we can all relate to each other. So we don't tiptoe around each other about around food. We're all curious. So that's one project that I did well.
I love it. It's like food's like a social lubricant, isn't it? I mean, some people say is. Alcohol is, but the food. Yep. Okay. Keep going. Food. So you did that.
Yeah. So I did that. And then I also went on this trend of like, I really was interested in knowing the Australian woman. She was very intriguing to me. And I wanted to really see her in her natural habitat. So I went and worked in Brighton Homes as a cleaner.
Mm.
And I started to understand, I wanted to see her in the background and how does she parent? She was very intriguing to me. So, and then I went into aged care centers. I worked there as well. And having done all these projects, I realized that amidst the beauty and the glory around, you know, Brighton, there was also a less apparent truth because I connected with the pain of Brighton as well.
Wow.
I connected with, you know, young children roaming in shopping malls because there was no one home to go to. And this is just, you know, I'm just generalizing here of just what I observed. And it's not to say that it's all that. And I don't like making these generalizations, but those are the things that I saw. And I saw, you know, mental health. I saw, you know, all the things that are normal in other communities. But here they were just hidden with material.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and that became to me like, oh, wow, these people have pains as well. You know, they're human like me. So that's then where my mission of wanting to bring the Brighton women and myself from my cultural background together and to create this space, a safe space where women could interact, could connect, could share their stories. And I call it a circle of grace, because in a circle of grace, we can bring our grievances and we can sit in this space of compassion and connect and, you know, unravel our mystery, so to speak. Yeah. So that's where, and at that time I did a permaculture course, which led me to see my backyard. I was like, oh, I have this big backyard. Why don't I use this space? And so then I started the community garden. And so that is a not-for-profit organization. It's called RAW, R-A-W, and it stands for Resilient Aspiring Women. And if you read RAW and you love mirrors, you look at RAW in a mirror, it's war. So what I realized is that women harbor their wars inside while men take theirs out there.
Yeah.
And so I asked the women to stop the war inside and to tap into their resilience and aspirations. So that's what the metaphor of the raw garden means. And so we do that through the connection to nature. We're connecting to the land. We're connecting to our culture, whatever we've cooked. So we do cooking classes. We do, so we come back to the simplicity of life. We do a lot of different things. We create things with our hands. We have a beautiful water bottles. We created this beautiful wall and we have bottles in it and we call it our pillar of light and love. Light because the light comes in, but love because there's all the bottles that are in it are from wine drunk by other people, but maybe all the celebrations and our hard work in creating it is the love. So we have that. We now have four letters of love in the garden, and these are massive letters, and they were brought in by this man. A beautiful story, actually. One day I was sitting with my friend and she was complaining to me. And I said, look, people like you and me, Mel, always complain. But negative people, the people who want to seed love, complain all the time. And we're not diligent in our work. But people who are creating negativity wake up every morning and do their stuff. So let's make a pact here and seed love in our community. Let's always look at the positive aspects of our lives and create this. And then as we are speaking, this man, and this is a literal story. If Mel was not sitting with me, I would not be able to tell this story. And he comes in and he says, are you Mariam? And I said, yes. And he said, I have a gift for you. I watched the Raw Garden. We were featured in Gardening Australia. And I saw this garden and I knew that these four letters belonged in your garden. And he dropped in four huge love letters.
Wow. So literally L-O-V-E he gave
to you. L-O-V-E he gave us. And we were literally talking about seeding love in our community.
Hang on, Mariam. Hang on.
This is too weird for you to understand?
No, I just believe like there's something divine and
yes.
something going on there. So you'd never met this man?
I have never met this man. He just saw our program maybe weeks before. And you know what he added? He also added that, oh, I wanted to send you an email, but I knew you were open today. So I just wanted to drop it in.
Oh, so he actually came to the garden.
He came to the garden. And friend and I haven't even finished our conversation.
Wow, dude, that's are you sure he wasn't an angel? He was an angel. How tall are they compared to you? Are they taller than you?
Yes, the letters? They are 1 point, I think. They're very tall. They're taller than me. I'm 5'9", but they would be 1 meter, I think. 1.8 meters, I think.
1.8 meters, so a bit taller than you. That's amazing.
Yes, yes.
So when you,
So let me tell you what we did with the letters. We invited four different women artists from four different parts of the world, did each letter.
Wow.
So one was done by an Indigenous woman, one was done by a white Australian woman, one was done by an Iranian woman, who also came as a refugee, and one was done by an African Colombian woman.
Wow.
Yeah. Beautiful artists. Four different, you know, women put their artwork on each letter.
You know,
the four letters were sponsored by four businesswomen in Bayside.
I love that.
Yeah.
You know what you need? Mariam, you definitely don't need, but I'm just going to tell you. You need a big exclamation mark at the end, and you need a female graffiti artist to come and do some graffiti just to offset all the.
Offset that.
So if people want to follow your work or connect with you or follow you on social media or find you, how do they do that?
So they do that through my work with my daughter. So we have as I am doing all this work, Craig, I just became a brand. So the Mariam Issa brand is a brand that works with women. We do life coaching, we do storytelling, and we support women to really connect with their story and to unlock the potential that lives in them and to be resourceful, you know, because the resources are there. All we need is to be resourceful and to find that resourcefulness within ourselves. And, you know, so they can find us on mariamissa.com.au. We are both speakers. We are on stage, but we are also we hold workshops as well, leadership workshops, wellness and health, a lot of different workshops, how to unlock your potential, how to connect with your resilience. And, you know, I do the work that I do is a work that I am really passionate about, because I feel that there's an amazing rippling effect when, you know, women hear, connect. It has the ability to, you know, to connect to the world. And I think we as women have to find our highest, truest expressions of who we are, so that the world that has been, you know, unleveled or has been unbalanced can come back to balance. Mm. And I think that's, you know, when we take back our power, we have the ability really to give power to life itself, because we are the creators of life. We are the wombs of creation.
And you certainly are. You certainly make us men look like dumbasses sometimes. You're an inspiration. I love chatting with you. Do you need to be can dudes go to the garden, or is it ladies only?
Oh, yes. No, no, it's not a ladies only. We do invite our RAMs. We call them our RAMs, you know, our resilient aspiring men. So how can the RAM be excluded?
I want to be a RAM, dude.
The RAM. Yes. So we do. And a lot of the work actually, and that is built. The garden is built on almost, we have now about, I think more than $200,000 has gone into the work. And it's been done by men and women of the community. Each tree, and we have 38 fruit trees, each tree was adopted by a community member, and it was planted with an intention. So we have trees of love and trust and acceptance and connection and community. And yeah, you can bring a tree as a gift to Craig, and you can give it an intention of what you would want for your world.
I love it. I'm going to bring a tree of healing. That's what I'm bringing.
A tree of healing. I love that. I love that.
The healing tree.
Yeah, the healing tree.
Mariam, we really appreciate you being on the You Project. I loved getting to know a little bit about your story. I feel like there's more. So we might get you back at some stage if you're available. But, yeah, thanks for being part of our lives for a minute. And you don't need luck because you're doing the work. But congratulations on what you're doing and all the best for what's coming up in the future. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Greg. I really enjoyed our conversation, and you held me in a circle of grace. That was really, I appreciate that, because that's true hosting. Thank you.
Pleasure. You stay right there. Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
Tiff, I'm almost emotional.
Me too. That was really good.
I know. I love her. I love you. You're so good.
I love
good.
You too, Craig.
I have a little bit of a crush, but you're married, so that's okay.
No, I'm not married, actually, but
well,
I don't know.
That's a door that's just opened. Oh, that just got awkward, didn't it?
It did get awkward, but I don't know. Yeah, you never know. Let's not put any bats onto it. Let's just leave it at that.
Oh, is it hot in here?
Just quietly. I watched that whole conversation thinking, Craig looks like he's swooning a little bit.
Well, I'm only human. I'm only human. I'm just a man. Stay there, you two, and stop being ridiculous. Thanks, everyone. I'm off on a date, apparently. Look after yourselves. Love you guts. See you, everyone.